And now, a look back at 1 year of TV news with pandemic precautions.
You may have noticed something a little different about tonight's newscast.
Like many of you, everyone at CBS 17 is practicing social distancing.
We are standing 6 feet apart here on the set.
Yeah, it's social distancing.
So this is 6 feet right here.
It feels like I have to shout at you now.
I know.
But we have microphones and we don't.
I'm coming to you live this morning from my own home in Boardman.
You look great sitting there all set up at a studio at home.
What's happening?
Olivia is calling. Somebody answer Olivia.
I mean, we can say hi.
Someone answer that, please.
At I-65, gonna go ahead and apologize. My Alexa is going off. Alexa, off.
A downstream effect that's playing out across the system. I'm sorry you're hearing my dog bark at the mailman there.
So it's been a week since I've seen her. Hi, this is my cat. That is the perks of working from home.
The maps aren't gonna move because he just whacked the computer with his head. So let me just verbalize the forecast.
62 in Pasadena. We'll talk about this storm. He walks now, guys, so I've lost all control.
Hold on 1 second. Sorry.
Tea biscuits.
Yes, you can have tea biscuits.
Sorry about that.
And run to the Supreme Court, as they've indicated. Clearly, that's failed. They've refused to intervene. And ultimately, now, those ballots are going to be counted.
Oh, my God.
You know, I understand why people do their show from their home, but if we ever did, it just wouldn't feel right.
Right.
That's why we have maintained our...
You're a pioneer.
We mm-hmm. just wouldn't do that. Anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is so funny, though, to see, especially the dogs and the kids and the cats. I love it. I actually love it. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Monday, March 15th. Daylight savings kicked in.
How you feeling?
It can be a little brutal, actually.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire.
How you feeling this morning, Jonathan, daylight savings time?
Joe, I'm a little tired, but I'm always a little tired. And watching those clips, one of the biggest surprises of the pandemic is that neither my 9-year-old or 6-year-old have invaded my shot at any point. But
yet.
We still probably have a few more months of this. There's still time.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's lots of time.
You got time.
The host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton, joins us this morning, as well as Washington anchor for BBC World News America, Katty Kay joins us. Good to have you all on board. So the U.S. hit a daily record for coronavirus vaccinations over the weekend. That's kind of nice to say that we hit a new kind of record. But there are growing concerns about what it will take to convince enough Americans to be vaccinated in order to stop the spread. Yesterday on Fox News, Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked about a concerning new poll that shows Republican men, in particular, those who supported President Trump, are reluctant to get the vaccine.
According to a recent poll, 49% of Republican men said they don't intend to get the vaccine. How much of a difference will it make if President Trump leads a campaign for the people who are most devoted to him to actually go out and get the vaccine?
Chris, I think it would make all the difference in the world. He's a very widely popular person among Republicans. If he came out and said, go and get vaccinated, it's really important for your health, the health of your family, and the health of the country, it seems absolutely inevitable that the vast majority of people who are his close followers would listen to him. I'm very surprised at the high percentage of Republicans who say they don't want to get vaccinated. I don't understand where that's coming from. This is not a political issue. This is a public health issue.
Yeah, you know, Katty Kay, as always, the president is such a hypocrite. He gets the shot himself in private.
Secretly, he and Melania.
Yeah, he and Melania secretly get it.
In January.
And then they won't show anybody else and won't tell other people to get it. And he's been playing with conspiracy theories his entire presidency. And now 47% of GOP people who supported Donald Trump are now saying they're not going to get the vaccine. It's this personality cult issue. And you wonder why the president who got it himself doesn't tell everybody else, get the shot.
We know that the one thing that is critical, if we're going to get to that July 4th deadline,
and make it that Joe Biden lined out this weekend for being the kind of return to normalcy. It's not going to happen unless large numbers of Americans get the vaccine, right? The vaccine is our way out of this. We all know that. World leaders around the world have got their vaccines in public in order to persuade their voters, the people who support them and follow them, to get the vaccine themselves. We know the power of role models in this. We've seen role models in the African American community come out and say specifically, we are trying to get you because you believe in me, I'm going to get my shot in public, so that we know that it does work. For Donald Trump, though, to do it in public, I guess would be, I mean, he said it at CPAC. He did say, go and get your shot. To be fair, he came out in public at CPAC, but that was just people who were listening to CPAC, I guess, that heard that. But for him to go on camera and do it would have a huge amount of influence on the people who have, you know, support him to the end of the world would clearly go and get it if he got it in public. But for him to get it in public would be what? Somehow admitting that Joe Biden had some kind of credit or coming out in credit. That's why he didn't take part, I guess, in that PSA announcement with the other former presidents. He doesn't want to give any kind of credit to this administration. So doing anything perhaps that would help this administration, I guess that's why he's not wanting to do it now.
Joe, doesn't he take credit for the beautiful shot?
Yeah.
I mean, he takes credit for it in terms of the accomplishment that the Biden administration put together so quickly in record time compared to his botched response to the pandemic, where he didn't pretend it existed for months or came up with literally like crazy ideas that came out of nowhere. Out of some crackpot's brain, like putting bleach in your body to get rid of it. He came up with crazy ideas to counter it, but he never actually got anything substantial done. In fact, most people would say what he did during his time as president during this pandemic led to more deaths.
Well, so you have a couple things going on here, and Caddy, that's right, he did say something in passing at CPAC, but he didn't. I was talking about the presidents. He didn't go on, didn't do the PSA announcement. He's not gotten out there telling people, go get your shots. And Reverend Al, how interesting that Donald Trump and all of his supporters will screech and yell about the importance of Operation Warp Speed, and why isn't he getting enough credit for Operation Warp Speed? Well, he should get credit for Operation Warp Speed. But how bizarre, if that's such a big damn deal, why are one in two Republicans, for the most part, not getting the vaccine or saying they're not going to get the vaccine? And why isn't Donald Trump, if he thinks it's such a big damn deal, if he thinks he created such a, quote, beautiful shot, why isn't he making sure that people are getting it so we can open this country back up?
This is the real display of the real pettiness and dark side of this president. He wants to take credit for something, yet he won't promote what he's taking credit for. But at the bottom of it is he shows a real insensitivity, if not a sense of not caring about the health and life and death of his own followers. He rather play these games with Biden of who's going to get credit and I'm not going to enhance what Biden is doing, rather than say, wait a minute, we have to be concerned about the very people that voted for me, that support me, and that still support me. At some point, I don't care how big an egomaniac you are, you should be concerned about the public if you're a public servant. And it shows how really hollow this man is in terms of any moral concern for anyone outside of himself.
So let's just make this very simple. If the president wants to go off and say nothing, that's fine. It's not his responsibility anymore. Yeah. But if he's going to keep taking credit for the vaccine, if he's going to put out press releases about the vaccine, if he's going to talk about his beautiful shot, if his people are going to keep whining about how he's not getting enough credit for Operation Warp Speed, which he should get credit for Operation Warp Speed. If he's going to be engaged in that debate, then you know what? Then stay engaged in that debate and do what's best for America and do what's best for your supporters. Do what's best for your supporters' families. Do what's best for your supporters' grandkids, grandparents, everybody. Do what's best for reopening the schools, reopening small businesses. Tell your supporters to go out and get the vaccine. Let them know it's safe. You took it. We all know what a hypochondriac you are, Donald. You're the biggest hypochondriac I've ever met in my life. So you wouldn't take that shot. As a hypochondriac and a germaphobe, you wouldn't take that shot unless you knew it was safe.
Why can't you share that with your people?
So again, you've always... So it's been weird when people have asked you, Donald, questions about these anti-vaxxing things. You've always sort of skirted in the middle and refused to strike down the anti-vax movement. You've always skirted the middle whenever asked about QAnon. You won't come out and say it. And okay, well, again, that's your business. You lost. You can keep acting that way because you don't represent anybody. But again, if you want to be engaged in the debate over vaccines, then be engaged in a positive way. Be engaged in a way that can actually save lives going forward. You made a lot of mistakes. You know you did. You know, Donald, you were responsible for a lot of deaths. Mm-hmm. You know that's going to stay with you and throughout, you know, decades, years to come in the history books. Just be positive here and get that one out of two Republicans that voted for you. Tell them to do what you did. Get the vaccine. Save themselves, save their families from a possible bad situation, and let's get this country opened up again.
NBC News safely. Senior national correspondent Kate Snow has more on the effort to convince Americans to get the vaccine.
At Holy Name Medical Center in New Jersey, I met so many who'd been desperate to get a vaccine appointment.
It's overwhelming, and I feel that I'm lucky.
But there are also millions rejecting it.
Well, I'm not getting the vaccine because I'm honestly not scared of the virus.
I don't trust the vaccine at all.
Many of them white conservatives like Gina Militello. She's a mom of four who works in a school and voted for former President Trump.
Public health officials and scientists and leading doctors are saying we should get this vaccine. Why are you so concerned about it?
I don't think that it's 100% safe and effective. And I believe that the risk is worse than what the benefit would be.
You're concerned that it hasn't been tested enough?
Yes.
A new poll finds nearly half of Trump voters do not plan to get the vaccine, compared to just 10% of Biden voters. Dr. Melody Weaver runs a clinic in rural Idaho.
You have people believing that masks don't matter. The vaccine's a conspiracy, and maybe they're out to get us.
It's a huge concern for Dr. Paul Offit, who serves on the FDA panel that approved the vaccines.
And this country needs everyone to get this vaccine, right? Or at least a certain percentage of people to eventually get to herd immunity.
You're right. We need about 80% at least of the population to be immune.
Dr. Ashish Jha is at Brown University.
It's politicized now. You hear people say, I don't believe in this administration. I don't believe in these vaccines.
Yeah, this is one of the more disturbing things in my mind, kind of disturbing turn of events. There's nothing political about this virus. The virus doesn't care if you're a Democrat or Republican, and the vaccines work just as well for Democrats and Republicans.
For me, as a scientist who's also a Christian, this is an answer to a lot of prayers.
Public health officials are targeting conservative media, and a new public service announcement features former presidents, including Republican George W. Bush.
It's important for our fellow citizens to get vaccinated.
But not Donald Trump, who got his vaccine privately.
What if your employer says you need to get the shot before going back to school?
I would have to find another job.
Why is it so important for every one of us to get this vaccine?
My message is really simple. We want to put it behind us. We want to get our lives back. We want to be able to see family and friends. The best and only real way we can do that is if most Americans get vaccinated.
Make that choice, because not to make that choice is not only to put yourself at risk, but to put everyone with whom you come in contact at risk.
So this is where the alternative facts environment that so many Donald Trump supporters live in. This is where it impacts them. And it's not people living the Ozarks, living in a tent. It's everybody. It's, you know, one of my friends who's highly educated, who's got a lot of children, who's got, you know, and people that obviously got a household that needs to be safe. He refuses to take the shot. He's a Donald Trump supporter. He's been educated. He knows better. He should know better, but he's not going to. And Jonathan Lemire, can you help us out here? Because you obviously followed Donald Trump This is a public health crisis that we obviously have to get behind us. And we can't do that if one half of the 75 million people who voted for Donald Trump aren't going to get the vaccines. I mean, it's bad for them. It's worse for them, but it's bad for this country. Can you explain Donald Trump's hesitancy to go public with this based on everything you've seen in the past, how we sort of skirted questions on anti-vaxxing issues or QAnon issues?
Well, Joe, you hit on a few of the pieces of this already. Certainly, his history with anti-vaxxers is well documented, and the reluctance to do something that would appear to give Joe Biden any sort of credit, that too. But there's a little bit more people that I've talked to around him. I mean, first, just so trivial, but the idea of the sort of an embarrassing idea that the president, you know, he didn't want the photo shot. I thought he would look weak if he had to have a shot in the arm with his sleeve rolled up. There's that. He doesn't want that on camera. But also, as part of the QAnon or his refusal to denounce the QAnon or the white supremacists, this is Trump's always had this reluctance to say anything that would upset people that already support him. And he knows. He knows that there are a number of Republicans and Trump supporters in particular, who don't want to have the vaccine, who perhaps his fear is would be alienated if he was suddenly out there relentlessly promoting it. And of course, this is all backwards because they don't want to take the vaccine because of the anti-science approach that he and people around him have taken for years. And now he could indeed be the person to change that, but he doesn't want to alienate them. So it's in this terrible cycle that doesn't seem to want to be broken and is dangerous for them and for all of us. And I will say this current White House is aware of this, that they know now soon enough that the challenge with the vaccine is not going to be supply. There's going to be enough supply. The challenge is going to be convincing Americans to take it, distributing it to where it needs to go, and getting those reluctant to take the vaccine to actually do so. And Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, was asked this week about exactly this. Is Joe Biden the right messenger for conservatives? She acknowledged perhaps not, that it would be useful to have a conservative figure get out there and advocate it. President Trump could be that person, but he, to this point, is refusing to do so.
Even though, again, as you said, even though he got the shot himself in private. Hey, Jonathan, let me ask you really quickly while we have you, and then we'll go on and do the story about Governor Andrew Cuomo's problems in New York. What's the White House's response to the Cuomo scandals, let's say scandals, the nursing home scandals, And then all the women who've come forward. What is the White House's response after Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand? You go down the list, a lot of leaders in New York State, both on the state and the national level, all calling for his resignation. Where is the White House?
The White House publicly is trying to steer clear, as difficult as that has been. I pressed Jen Psaki last week in the briefing room about this very matter, and her line was, well, the investigation is ongoing. We should see where it goes. I also said to her, but wait, Governor Cuomo is in charge of the COVID-19 response, the vaccine distribution in the state of New York. Does the White House still have confidence in him? And she sort of danced around it, acknowledging, look, some of his pandemic gubernatorial powers have been stripped from him, he's in a difficult spot here. President Biden yesterday did publicly, he was asked about it as he came back from the White House, from Delaware. He again sort of said, well, there's an investigation that's going on. We should see where it leads us. But behind the scenes, there is real concern here. They know that Cuomo is damaged. In particular, when Schumer on Friday said that Cuomo should resign, that was perceived among many Democrats as sort of almost like the final straw. Though Cuomo was telling people he won't go, and it would probably take a push from Biden to actually get him to resign. To this point, the White House is saying no. They don't want to be stuck up in this like Barack Obama's White House was when David Patterson, another scandal engulfed governor of New York, was asked to step aside about a decade or so ago. It's a distraction. They're hoping it gets resolved on its own, but it may not. The president may get pulled into it further.
Well, here is President Biden, as he was asked yesterday, to weigh in on the mounting calls for New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to resign. Take a look.
Do you think Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign?
I think the investigation is underway and we should see what it brings us.
All right. So the investigation underway. Here are the latest developments concerning New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. A longtime advisor to Governor Cuomo reportedly called county officials to gauge their loyalty to the embattled governor amid an ongoing sexual harassment investigation. That's according to multiple officials who spoke to The Washington Post. One of the Democratic county executives that was recently contacted by Larry Schwartz, head of the New York's coronavirus vaccine rollout, filed an ethics complaint with the state attorney general's office. According to the Post, the executive feared retaliation against the county's vaccine supply if Schwartz was not pleased with his response to questions about supporting the governor. When contacted by the Post, Schwartz acknowledged making the calls as a 30-year friend of Cuomo's, but said he, quote, did nothing wrong. Schwartz said that he did not discuss vaccines in the conversation. The governor has denied, by the way, touching anyone inappropriately, though he has apologized for any past behavior that may have made people uncomfortable.
Hey, Reverend Al, let's be straight here. If you've got the guy that's in charge of your vaccine rollout calling county officials, seeing whether they're still loyal to Andrew Cuomo or not, you don't have to tell them that they're answer is freighted with real meaning for whether they're going to get the vaccinations that they need. It's obvious that why Cuomo, which is disgusting, it's obvious why he had his vaccination czar, his coronavirus czar, calling these county officials. Show loyalty and maybe you get more vaccines. Don't show loyalty and you don't. And even if he didn't say anything, that was the clear suggestion with the person he chose to make those phone calls for him.
Well, no, at best, it is clearly not the person that should be making phone calls. And in fact, the implications are there. I think what a lot of people are torn with now is even those of us that have said, well, we're not going to call on him to resign. Let's see where the investigation goes. We have confidence in the investigation. Now have to raise the question, can he govern? And I think that there are two separate issues. One is whether you want to set a precedent where, based on accusations before an investigation, do you force someone out? But then the other part is if you have both the U.S. senators and the majority of the New York State legislature calling on you to resign, can you continue to govern in a state that is still facing critical issues? And I think that is where this morning many people, including me in the state, are looking at one of two very serious issues. In the middle of that, though, to have people that are going to be your representatives to be in positions that even remotely can be compromised, and this is not remote, I think only adds to the furor that a lot of people are trying to be clear-sighted before they make a ultimate decision. But I think when Schumer and Gillibrand came out and then the state legislators come out, it has raised this to a whole different level of whether or not you think he's guilty, but whether or not you think he can govern.
All right, so let's bring in Wall Street Journal reporter Jimmy Vielkind, who covers New York state politics and government from the state capitol in Albany. And I think we need to take a look at where these complaints stand, because the number has escalated since last week. And let's take a look at sort of the level of escalation as well. So who has come forward and what are the stories they're telling?
Well, Mika, so far we've heard from three former female aides to the governor who have described either sexual harassment or inappropriate workplace conduct by the Democratic executive. And there's a fourth woman who is currently on Andrew Cuomo's executive chamber staff who says that she was touched inappropriately by the governor during an encounter last year at the state executive mansion in Albany. That complaint was first reported by the Albany Times-Union and confirmed by the Wall Street Journal. In addition to these four women, there are several others who have come forward and described encounters they had with the governor, some at social encounters, some in other areas of the workplace. And all of this is going to be sucked up and reviewed by an independent investigation overseen by the state's attorney general, Letitia James. So as this process is unfolding, as Reverend Sharpton said, the political consequences are playing out, and the situation here in Albany changes not just day by day, but hour by hour. Right now, lawmakers are trying to finalize a state budget, but clearly the situation with the governor is having big implications.
I mean, it's got to be extremely distracting. And you mentioned one woman on his staff. Can you explain the parameters of that complaint, which I think she doesn't want to come forward? But how is that working? Is she still working on his staff? And how distracting that must be if you're trying to govern? Well,
our understanding is that she is still on his staff. An attorney for the woman says that she will speak at the appropriate time through the legal process. The Times Union has reported that the encounter involved Governor Cuomo asking for assistance with a technical issue on his phone. And again, according to the Albany Times Union, the woman says that the governor reached up her blouse and touched her breasts. She then sought to leave the executive mansion. Many people I'm talking to say that they see this as far more damning than some of the other alleged complaints. Other women have talked about comments from the governor. Charlotte Bennett, a 25-year-old scheduler, says that she felt Governor Cuomo was making overtures toward her for sex. And the governor, of course, has apologized, as you said, for making people feel comfortable. And I should note, he's denied inappropriately touching anyone, including the unnamed woman who said that she had the encounter with him in the executive mansion.
So, Jimmy, break down the numbers for us. As far as impeachment goes, obviously, there's an inquiry going on into impeachment. A good number of representatives, New York representatives, have asked the governor to step down. How much breathing space does he have in the assembly and in the Senate before he's looking at an impeachment process that actually could remove him from office?
Well, I think that the most critical person for Governor Cuomo's fate with respect to impeachment is Carl Hastie, the Democratic Speaker of the State Assembly. He comes from the Bronx, and thus far, he has not called for Governor Cuomo's resignation. The leader of our state Senate, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, has called for Governor Cuomo to step down. But in the state assembly, we know that there are approximately 39 Republican members. There are just 43 Republicans in the 150-seat chamber who say that Governor Cuomo should be impeached. There are 7 Democrats as of last week who have called for the governor's impeachment, but a larger number have said that Andrew Cuomo should step down. Again, this gets back to Reverend Sharpton's point about being able to effectively govern at a critical time for the state. That means that more than half the lawmakers in that chamber have said that they want to see Governor Cuomo leave office. But it's still a far cry from saying that they're ready to pass an impeachment resolution, which would require 75 votes, a majority of that 150-seat chamber, to pass.
The Wall Street Journal's Jimmy Vielkind, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning. Katty Kay, you know, how does this appear to you? Not only the view from abroad, a case like this, but just, you know, we cover stories about women's empowerment and making sure that women are heard and taken seriously. Where does this stand in the sea of cases like this that we have seen sort of cross our desks over the past 5 years?
Yeah, I think for many women, it had felt over the last year or so that the whole Me Too movement had kind of quietened down and we hadn't heard much about it. And women were starting to ask, well, what did we actually achieve? And then the Cuomo case has brought the whole movement back into focus again. And what do we always look for in cases like this where there are allegations against a powerful man? It's often a pattern of behavior, right? So it's not just one allegation. It's whether there are more allegations. And I think that's why the reporting that we're having now that, you know, there are now 4 women who have made allegations against the governor. And this latest one, which is of a particularly sexual nature and is physical, I think could be a turning point if that were to come out in public. And then the governor losing support around him. I mean, there's a reason the governor is losing so much of that support. And it was interesting listening to that reporting there from Albany about just how many state legislature members are now either calling for impeachment or calling for the governor to resign voluntarily. He just has no base of support. And so you think, well, where is that coming from? Why does he have no friends? It doesn't seem to me like it's just these few individual allegations, it seems like there is a culture. So you look for the culture in the organization and you look for the repeated allegations and the pattern of behavior. And I think that's when you start thinking there's something there. And I just don't see how the governor can carry on governing effectively in the middle of a pandemic when he doesn't have the support of the people around him.
Yeah. All right, Katie, thank you. Still ahead on Morning Joe, Republican Senator Ron Johnson says he didn't feel threatened during the deadly Capitol riot and adds that he may have felt differently if the mob had been Black Lives Matter protesters. Oh, my God. Plus, when it comes to bipartisanship, some Democrats are drawing the line with the events of January 6th. NBC's Leanne Caldwell joins us with her new reporting on that. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
I knew that even though those thousands of people there were marching to the Capitol were trying to pressure people like me to vote the way they wanted me to vote, I knew those are people that love this country, that truly respect law enforcement, would never do anything to break a law. And so I wasn't concerned. Now, had the tables been turned, Joe, this could be in trouble. Had the tables been turned and President Trump won the election, and those were tens of thousands of Black Lives Matter and Antifa protesters, I might have been a little concerned.
Okay, so first of all, let's get a couple things straight. So that guy, Ron Johnson, said that the people who were bashing law enforcement officers' brains in with American flags and cracking their skulls in trying to by jamming their head in doors, that were beating law enforcement officers to death. And the law enforcement officers were saying that they were sure they were going to die and were wondering how their four girls were going to survive without having their father because he'd been killed by Trump terrorists. These people right here, these are the people that Ron Johnson says truly respect law enforcement. No, they actually brutalized law enforcement. They actually beat up police officers, abused police officers, beat them with American flags. What they did was despicable and showed utter contempt for law enforcement, showed utter contempt for police officers. It was really disgraceful. And so, you know, Reverend Al, when Ron Johnson's this quote became available this weekend, somebody said, well, this is how racism works subconsciously. I said, well, not really. There's nothing subconscious about this racism. This is overt bigotry where Ron Johnson says that he is more concerned by Black Lives Matter marchers than he is with white rioters, white seditionists, white criminals who are now white convicts who keep getting rolled up and arrested by the FBI. And here's the takeaway that I think is actually the most disturbing part of this. Ron Johnson wants his listeners to know that he's a bigot. He wants his listeners to know that he's more afraid of black marchers, black protesters than he is with white rioters, white seditionists, white terrorists who brutalize police officers and commit sedition against the United States of America.
Well, what is so unbelievable is that this man is sitting in the U.S. Senate and has no problem at all being not an unconscious bigot, but a proud, proclaimed bigot, saying, let me explain to you my bigotry, my bias. He literally says that these people came into the chamber to try and deal with how I would vote, which means that he acknowledges they wanted to deal with the certification of the Electoral College. But there's nothing wrong with that. But had they been black, had they been somebody else, for whatever reason, I might have been disturbed about that. But they can bash policemen, even crush one law enforcement person who died. That's all right. They're law abiding because they have the right to be disruptive if they're going to stop an election. They have the right. In fact, they're not even doing anything illegal to beat on law enforcement people. This is expressions of the Confederacy, if I ever heard it. Ron Johnson is a disgrace to his office to stand there and represent something that 150 years ago, Jefferson Davis would have been applauding.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seemed like he was purposefully letting listeners know that he was a bigot, that white terrorists, Trump terrorists, scared him less than black people marching. You know, Mika, Ron, though, also may not be the sharpest tool in the shed, because by admitting that they were coming up and attacking the Capitol to try to stop him from certifying the electoral votes, he actually helps prove, if you look at the statute, he helps prove one of the points that needs to be proved in proving sedition,
yes,
that you were coming and you were committing violence in hopes to stop a legal process by the United States government or a constitutional process by the United States government. So I'm sure the prosecution in all the cases appreciate Ron Johnson, a sitting senator, stating that, yes, that's exactly what they were trying to do.
Extremely helpful. That's for
sure. Thank you, Ron.
Some Democratic lawmakers are now saying that they won't work with any Republicans who voted against affirming the certification of the election, by the way. NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Leanne Caldwell has that reporting, and she joins us now. So how's that going to work, Leanne?
Well, Mika, it's becoming a big issue on Congress among Democrats. There's a deep mistrust on Congress that we're seeing in various ways. You saw House Speaker Nancy Pelosi put up the magnetometers outside the House chamber. But also what's happening is that individual Democratic offices are creating their own litmus tests on who they're going to work with on legislation. And we're not necessarily talking about the big headline grabbing legislation like COVID relief or the George Floyd bill or immigration, things like that. But the nitty gritty small pieces of bills that do pass through the House, do pass the Senate and reach the president's desk. And there's a lot of lawmakers who went on the record, which is what I was surprised about, to tell me about these individual litmus tests. For example, Representative Brad Schneider of Illinois, a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus that is usually works across the aisle with Republicans, he told me that he has a task force that he leads with Representative Jody Heiss of Georgia on this toxic contamination. He had to tell Representative Heiss that he can no longer be co-lead that task force with him because of how he voted and his statements since the insurrection. And I have a long list of examples of Democrats who are just telling their Republican colleagues that they can't work with them anymore.
Yeah, this is definitely the line. NBC's Leanne Caldwell, thank you for that reporting. Appreciate it. And coming up, the Biden administration works to stock up enough COVID vaccine doses for every American, and then some. Now the U.S. is facing pressure to free up some shots to share with the rest of the world. We'll get into that next on Morning Joe. Welcome back to Morning Joe. It is 46 past the hour. It's Daylight Savings. The first Monday after Daylight Savings is always kind of hard.
Yay.
Kind of wake up there in the White House. Biden administration officials tell NBC News the United States has no plans to share its stockpile of AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine with other countries, despite requests from the European Union. Right now, the Food and Drug Administration is waiting for additional data on the AstraZeneca vaccine before deciding whether to clear it for use in the U.S. The vaccine is already being used in Europe. Officials there have asked the United States to share some of its stockpiled doses in order to help with vaccine shortages in the European Union. Jonathan Lemire is still with us, and I'm just wondering, before we get to our next guest, Jonathan, what is the logic inside the White House as it pertains to this one particular vaccine that's not available for U.S. usage yet?
Right, Mika. And I asked White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki this at the end of last week in her daily briefing. And she made clear that and this was the most forthright the White House has been about this particular topic. They are not going to be sharing their vaccine supply with the rest of the world anytime soon until more Americans have it. She has said that President Biden's focus is getting Americans inoculated and with Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson. Those three approved already. But there are, as noted, there's contracts. There's AstraZeneca vaccines the U.S. has purchased, not approved yet. But right now, they're wanting to hold on to this. They feel like the approval process could happen the next couple of weeks. They still want to have that supply on hand for Americans. But as noted, they face some criticism that they're not sharing it with the rest of the world, missing out on a chance to engage in vaccine diplomacy, but also helping countries that are having trouble generating their own supply.
So joining us now, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, and U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Ed Luce. And Ed, you warned about this issue of countries keeping vaccine doses in a piece back in January entitled The West's Vaccine Myopia. And you write in part this: we've heard increasingly urgent warnings about vaccine nationalism. A better term would be vaccine myopia. In theory, nationalists are putting their own country first, or continent in the case of the EU. In a global pandemic, that approach makes no sense. If protecting your people is a priority, as it must be, nationalist logic should endorse global vaccine equity. Either the West tackles coronavirus globally, or we totally wall ourselves off, which we can't do, Ed. So what you're saying is that if you attack this globally, there's a chance we can really put an end to it. If we are nationalistic about it, we risk the vaccine coming back. I mean, the coronavirus coming back.
Yeah, I mean, what I think we need to pursue is enlightened nationalism here. That we're only as safe as the rest of the world, that say America gets herd immunity by June and Europe maybe a bit later in the year, but that the developing world, which is the majority of the world's population, only has about 20% vaccination by the end of 2021, which is what the projections are, only a fifth of people outside of the West, then you're going to see first of all, a perfect climate for more variations and mutations of this virus to develop and spread and come back across our borders, because there are no walls that can stop viruses from moving. But you're also going to see a failed economic recovery in the rest of the world. And our economic recovery is going to be contingent on a return of the global economic machine. So on many levels, you know, both health, epidemiological, but also in terms of our economic self-interest, we should be leading the way to get vaccines into the arms of people in Africa and South Asia, in Latin America. That's as much of a should be as much of a priority for us as getting our own people vaccinated.
Yeah, Richard Haass, Katty Kay is with us, and she has a question for you, Katty.
Yeah, so Richard, we know that politics likes a vacuum, and if the United States isn't doing something, somebody else probably is. China has distributed half a billion doses of its vaccine to 45 countries around the world, and they clearly think that it's in their self-interest to do so. Isn't it in America's self-interest to do so as well?
100%. Ed's exactly right. It makes sense in terms of our own physical recovery. It makes sense in terms of our own economic recovery. There is a sense of diplomatic competition. But let me give you another argument. One of the biggest crises facing the Biden administration is the surge of people coming in across to the southern border. One of the reasons that surge is going to continue and grow is if there's a major gap between the public health situation in the United States and, say, Central America, and the economic situation in the United States and Central America. If we want to narrow that gap and reduce the pressure along the southern border, one of the best ways to do it is by either sending vaccines over there, or in many cases, we won't even have to do that, Patty. We can license the production of American-originated vaccines in the rest of the world. So that way, we're not even taking anything away from ourselves in order to help others. This is actually a really straightforward question that the president should get out there and explain
why helping others helps ourselves.
So, Richard, you mentioned the situation at the border. The Biden administration is deploying FEMA to the U.S.-Mexican border to help care for the surging number of unaccompanied migrant teens and children overflowing detention cells and tent shelters. The deployment marks another escalation in the administration's response to the growing crisis. According to reports, about 8,500 teens and children are living in shelters run by Health and Human Services as unaccompanied minors arrive more quickly than officials can place them with sponsors. The New York Times notes that roughly 4,000 young people were in customs and border protection facilities last week. That's more than the roughly 2,600 children and teenagers held in such detention facilities back in June of 2019. The acting commissioner of CBP said nearly 9,500 children, including teenagers, were detained at the border without a parent in February. That is up from more than 5,800 in January. So I guess, first of all, Richard, what's the reason behind these rising numbers?
A couple of reasons. Some, as I just explained, are because of the growing gaps and conditions in some of these countries in the United States linked to COVID, linked to the economy. Some of these people are leaving for the reasons they always have, a fear of violence, crime, drug cartels, and the rest. But also the administration has somewhat brought this on itself by signaling during the campaign and the rest that we are going to have a more open, humane immigration policy. The message has gone out. And so people are coming here to test just that. And I think it's putting the administration in a real jam. There's a lot of pressure on it to maintain not just the rhetoric, but adopt such a policy. But if we do, tens and hundreds of thousands of people could head in this direction, and we're simply not ready for it. So the real question is, are we going to adopt a tougher policy at the border? And again, as we used to say, go to the source, try to address the problems in Mexico, in Central America, and elsewhere that are driving people to leave in the first place.
Well, and Ed Luce, Richard's right. Part of the problem is that the Biden administration announced such a permissive immigration policy to try to counteract what's been what had been going on over the past 4 years in the Trump administration, that they did invite some of this on themselves. And while they are not deliberately separating children from parents, as the Trump administration did, that was their stated policy. They even voted on it. They still have a humanitarian crisis at the border now, in part because there are flood of potential immigrants and potential refugees who think they're going to have a better shot of getting in now that Joe Biden's president, and he's sending sort of a friendlier signal to them.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he can do to stop this, because you know Biden is not going to endorse the sort of draconian measures that were put in place under Trump and to some extent under the previous Obama-Biden administration. He's just not going to do that, and nor should he. I mean, the separation of children from parents, et cetera, and turning away children, that's ended. They're not turning away children at the border. And I can't see Biden, for everything that he stands for, climbing down on this for the sake of stemming the flow of people to the border. So I would agree fully with what Richard just said. You have to go to the source here. You know, one of the reasons that the flow has got much higher and is expected to continue to get higher is because of the effect of the pandemic on Central Asia, American countries that had already been suffering all kinds of things, you know, gang warfare, the effects of climate change, junta regimes, etc. The Biden administration can focus on countries like Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico, helping them with a COVID vaccine rollout and with assistance to, including human rights assistance, to try and make life more palatable for people there without becoming Trumpian on the border. Because I don't think that Biden wants to do that, and I don't think we should want Biden to do that.
All right. Thank you so much, Ed Luce. Thank you, Richard Haass. So the question is, how do we balance this Reverend Al. Obviously, Donald Trump had an inhumane policy as it pertained to illegal immigrants coming to our border. Barack Obama also had a very tough approach, which actually drove down illegal border crossings to a 50-year low. But what does the Biden administration do? How do they balance it? Because sending an open invitation to illegal immigrants to come to the United States of America is one way to guarantee that the southern border is always in a chaotic situation.
Balance is the word. I think when you look at the fact that you've got to have engagement with the countries they're running from. People are not running here for no reason. They're running from something. If we engage and try to resolve and solve some of the things they're running from, I think you can bring the flow down. But at the same time, you've got to stop the continued by the astronomical numbers is becoming to build up toward of people running in and our losing our ability to control the flow at the border when Americans, people here, are suffering with increased unemployment and hunger due to the pandemic.
All right, Reverend Al Sharpton and Caddy Kay, thank you both very much for being on this morning. And still ahead, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Tim Kaine, joins us here. Plus, top Democrats fan out across the country to promote the new COVID relief package. What to expect from the president and vice president this week? We're back in 1 minute.